On April the 10th, 1912, the Titanic set sail on its maiden voyage, traveling from Southampton, England to New York City. Who has never heard of the story about the infamous Titanic? Anybody? We're probably all quite familiar with that. There's been several movies made about it. There's been a number of documentaries made. There's been books written about it. But it's an event that took place over 100 years ago that I think all of us are familiar with. And the statistics or the facts, not statistics, but the facts that I'm going to give you here over the next minute or so, I've pulled from the Encyclopedia Britannica. And actually, if I gave you everything that was recorded there, we'd be here for half an hour or better reading through it. So I've just pulled some excerpts that I want to use this afternoon as I introduce this topic and the subject for today. It says, nicknamed the Millionaire's Special, the ship was fittingly captained by Edward J. Smith, who was known as the Millionaire's Captain because of his popularity with wealthy passengers. On the morning of April 11th, the liner made its last scheduled stop in Europe at Queenstown, Ireland. At approximately 1:30 p.m., the ship set sail for New York City. On board were some 2,200 people, approximately 1,300 of whom were passengers. Throughout much of the voyage, the wireless radio operators on the Titanic, who were Jack Phillips and Harold Bride, had been receiving iceberg warnings, most of which were passed along to the bridge. These two men worked for Marconi Company, and much of their job was relaying passengers' messages, not to warn about icebergs, but to relay communication to and from passengers back to their home locations. On the evening of April 14th, the Titanic began to approach an area known to have icebergs. Smith slightly altered the ship's course to head farther south. However, he maintained the ship's speed of some 22 knots. And 22 knots translates to approximately 25 miles per hour, which is pretty fast for a ship of its size, especially in the waters that they were getting ready to enter. Several messages were received from other ships that icebergs were seen in the area, but they were largely ignored and received little urgency. At 10:55 p.m., the nearby Leland liner, the Californian, sent word that it had stopped after becoming surrounded by ice. Phillips, who was handling passenger messages, scolded the Californian for interrupting him. So you can see as we go through some of these facts that not a lot of attention was paid to the fact that there might be danger ahead. Two lookouts, Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee, were stationed in the crow's nest of the Titanic. Their task was made difficult by the fact that the ocean was unusually calm this evening, or this particular evening, and the night was thick with darkness. You ever heard that term before, thick with darkness? At approximately 11:40, south of Newfoundland, Canada, an iceberg was sighted, and the bridge was notified. First Officer William Murdoch, who had the helm, ordered a hard turn, and the engines reversed. It was too late to avoid a collision. The ship's starboard side scraped along the iceberg, and at least five of its supposedly watertight compartments toward the bow were ruptured. Now, they didn't know how many were ruptured at the time. I think we only discovered that just recently when we found the Titanic that was at the bottom of the ocean in 2.5 mile deep water. And I should pause for a second to tell you, the ship was the latest in technology at the time it was built. And when it was launched, it had a double hull. And the compartments that were designed that if any breach occurred, that the water would fill up that particular compartment, and that would be the end of the problem. And they could maintain control of the ship, maintain its buoyancy until it was able to dock and be repaired. The only problem was they didn't anticipate that five of these compartments being breached at the same time. And another little known fact that came out afterwards was that the compartments were not watertight. They were sealed at the water level, but they were not sealed at the top. And so as these compartments took on water, what do you think the weight of water does? It pulls the ship down. And eventually the bow became so heavy with water that the water in the damaged compartments began to spill over into the compartments that had no damage. And once the crew realized what was happening, they knew that their fate had been sealed. Going on, it says, beginning at 11:50 p.m. on April 14th, several distress signals were sent, but all the ships who received the distress signals were too far away to respond in time to help the Titanic with its evacuation. In the end, some 3 hours after the iceberg was struck, the unsinkable Titanic sank. And out of just over 2,200 crew and passengers, 705 lives were saved. Now, I could have given you many more facts, but those are the relevant ones that I wanted to bring out here this afternoon. You know, many opinions have been given over the years. As I said, this happened over 100 years ago. The ship was discovered, I believe, about 20 or 25 years ago, and it was actually surveyed and explored by a submersible submarine. A special submarine was able to deal with 2,500 feet or 2.5 miles of water, 12,500 feet of water. But over the years, many have speculated what could have been done differently. And many contributing factors have been pointed out that could have created a scenario that changed what actually took place. One of those contributing factors was the overrepresentation of the strength of the ship. The engineers who designed it and built it were famous for saying that it was indestructible. But it was, wasn't it? It was destructible. And there's a number of reasons why, not only from this iceberg, but from other types of flaws that they later discovered in the ship. But in the end, the major contribution to its calamity, or contributions, I should say, there's really three of them. It was a lack of caution, the speed of the ship when it hit the iceberg, and the fact that it was going through an iceberg field in the middle of the night in complete darkness. If the ship had sailed the area during the day, it's likely that it would never have struck an iceberg. Had there been light that was shining out from the bow that would have illuminated the water up front, the ship's crew, those two that was in the crow's nest, probably would have been able to see the danger. They probably would have still hit the iceberg, but maybe they could have adjusted more quickly. So lack of caution, speed, and darkness. Darkness was a huge contributing factor. Turn with me, if you would, to Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs 4 is one of those chapters in Proverbs where wisdom is personified. But in Proverbs chapter 4, beginning in verse 18, Proverbs 4 beginning in verse 18, says, "The path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter into the perfect day." Verse 19, "The way," or the path, we might say, "of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble." They do not know. They can't see it. They can't understand. And then as we go back up a few verses to verse 14, notice what God inspired Solomon to write here. Verse 14 says, "Do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not walk in the way of the evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it and pass on." So here we see a use of darkness, whether it's literal darkness. In many cases, danger does occur with literal darkness, such as what happened to the Titanic. But there's also another element of darkness here that we'll talk about more as we go through this message, and that is spiritual darkness. Spiritual darkness also creates calamity. Let's go to 1 John 1. 1 John 1, and in verse 5, and there'll be certain parts of this message this afternoon. It will read a number of scriptures, but I'm not going to try to overwhelm you with scriptures this afternoon. But in 1 John 1, we'll look at one verse here. 1 John 1, verse 5. 1 John 1, verse 5. It says, this is the message. This is the Apostle John writing to the church. He said, this is the message which we have heard from him. John was there with Jesus Christ. John was a witness. John knew him personally. John walked, talked, and had many conversations with Jesus Christ, the one who gave his life for all of us. He says, this is the message we've heard from him. And I declare to you that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. God is light and in him is no darkness at all. And then 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 5. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 5. Paul writes, he says, you are all sons of light and sons of day. We, God's people, we are not of the night or of the darkness. Not of the night nor of the darkness. All who are God's chosen, called out ones, sons of light. In the New King James Version, light is used 253 times in Scripture. The word darkness is used 161 times. Now, these words are used when it's literally talking about light and literally talking about darkness. But there is a significant amount of usage of these two words as they contrast two ways of life. In fact, most of the time that these two words are used in the New Testament, it's dealing with just that. The contrast between good and evil, the contrast between righteousness and unrighteousness. Light and darkness in the Bible are often used as metaphors to contrast two ways of thinking, two ways of walking, two ways of conducting oneself. And I'm sure that we could all pause for a minute. You could write down a number of ways that you can think of now as to how those are used. I've already given you a couple of examples. What about godly versus ungodly, righteous versus unrighteous? We said good versus evil. How about God's way of life versus Satan's way? How about of the spirit or of the flesh? And then certainly, but not least, they represent conversion versus blindness or deception. So light and darkness are metaphors for a principle that God wants you and I to totally understand, and that for you and I to completely know where we stand. Do we stand in the light or do we stand in the darkness? You know, we're here in a period between the ending of one holy day cycle and getting ready to begin another holy day cycle. You know, it doesn't seem like it was that long ago that the Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day ended. But it's been, help me, 4 months? 5 months almost. Because last year was an early feast. So it's been 5 months. It's hard to believe that much time has passed. I can remember, like yesterday, being at the feast in England, in Winchester, England. But nevertheless, we're now removed 5 months from the Feast of Tabernacles. And we're getting ready to prepare for the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And I hope all of us, as we've had this time between the annual cycles of the holy days, to really begin to think about what are we going to do to prepare for the upcoming holy days. What's on our mind? Let's just Ask ourselves, what's on our mind? What's on my mind? What's on your mind? What have we been thinking about since we concluded the last great day? What thoughts have we been impacted by? What other potential issues that have come into our life that we've had to deal with that maybe has sidetracked us, or in some cases maybe really encouraged or enforced our spirituality? What's been going through our mind? You know, the world around us certainly isn't becoming any better, is it? In fact, we could say by the hour, by the day, it's growing darker and darker. It's been in that, or on that path for a long time, hasn't it? Just seems like it's being sped up as we go through the weeks and the months. But as we think about the approaching Holy Day season, and we know what is pictured by the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, you know, God being willing to give His life to pay for our sins, and then showing us how we are supposed to live a sinless life, sin-free. You know, we don't get to the Days of Unleavened Bread and then decide that, well, that's the time to put sin out. We should be putting out sin all of the time. When we come to the Days of Unleavened Bread, our focus should be on how are we living life that's representative of a life without sin, a life in the light, a life in the light. So when we think about where we are at in our spiritual journey, we should ask ourselves, has my light grown brighter or has it dimmed since the Feast of Tabernacles and the last great day? And then I'll ask us one more question. Are we currently the light that God expects us to be? That's a very difficult question to answer, but it's certainly one we should ponder. Are we the light that God expects you and me to be? So as we look forward to the upcoming Holy Day season, we should consider whether or not we are, in fact, as Paul told us, sons of light. Or do we still have corners of darkness that we've never dealt with? Maybe it's darkness that we don't even know that's there. But Paul said that we are to be sons of light. We're to become like Jesus Christ. And we just read that in God there is no darkness, only light. No darkness, only light. So let's look this afternoon at what God expects His lights, you and me, to be doing in this world that's growing darker and darker by the day. You know, there are times when I've watched a movie. Not many movies are made this way, and I don't watch a whole lot of movies either. I don't know how many are made in a year, but it's got to be hundreds, probably more than that if you include all of the independent movies that are made. But regardless of the number of movies that are made, there are always a few every year that begin with the ending. You ever watch one of those movies? The ending is first. And then the whole rest of the story goes back and shows the audience, how you got to that ending. So I want to start my sermon today by going to the ending. Let's go to Revelation chapter 21. Let's look at the end. Revelation chapter 21. This is where, well, the whole book of Revelation was given to John via vision. But John was allowed to see through vision something that's very, very special that I hope all of us are looking forward to. Revelation 21, let's begin in verse 22. If you read the earlier parts of this chapter, John is describing the new Jerusalem. But beginning in verse 22, he says, "But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The lamp is its light." No darkness. No darkness. No literal darkness. No spiritual darkness. Verse 24, "And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light." You know, those individuals who are there at this particular time. Now, again, we have to put this in context. There are no human beings alive at this point in time. You are either a son of God or you have been destroyed. I'm not talking about you as us, but as mankind, as humanity. This is the ultimate conclusion of this path of life that we're all walking on. Being part of that moment when Jesus Christ turns over his kingdom to the Father. And the Father and the Son dwell among men. Men not in flesh and blood, but individuals who were men, who are now spirit beings, part of God's family. But it says, those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honor into it. Verse 25, its gates shall not be shut at all by day. And then you can see parenthetically, because there's no night there. No night there. Verse 26, and they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. But there shall by no means enter it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, only those who are written in the book of life. So this is the point when flesh no longer exists. Sin is no longer found. Perfection dwells. And we would look at this and say, for those who are being called and worked with now, this is the moment when eternity begins, isn't it? This is when the eternity of light, both literally and spiritually, begins. This is when perfection will last forever. How long is eternity? What comes after this example that we've just read here in John chapter 21? You know, Christ said that he works. He said his Father works. But what does God have in store that will take place from this point forward? It's now a complete family, a family that's perfect, a family that walks as God's in the part of the God family. How long is eternity? Have you ever thought about what we'll be doing? Have you ever thought about how long eternity is? You know, God created us with certain limits, didn't he? Our mind cannot comprehend how God has always existed. If you can you explain? Somebody please explain that to me, because my mind can't deal with that. My mind also can't deal with living forever. How do I relate to that? I'll try to point this out to you in a minute. But how long is eternity? Have you ever just sat down and thought about how long is eternity? And then how do we fit in it, in the timeline? You know, I looked up the average life expectancy from 2018 in the United States. And you know what it is? For a man, it's 76 years. And for a woman, it's 81 years. How long is that compared to eternity? How long is that just compared to the last 6,000 years? It's really nothing, is it? It's really nothing. And of course, they say now that this life expectancy has peaked and will actually start coming down in the opposite direction. We've pretty much exhausted the benefits of drugs, but the bigger issue is the amount of opioids that are now infecting the population in this country, and it's causing the averages to decline. But let's say that the average person lives 70 to 80 years. Maybe a few people live into their 90s. Some of us were called at a young age. Some were called at an older, more mature age. So how long does God give us to learn to walk as sons of light compared to eternity? It's not very long, is it? Not very long at all. How long do we have to manifest God's character? You know, I've sat and thought about how long does this process take? A few thousand years ago, how long did man live? 500? 600? Few lived to be 900 years old. Now that compared to 70 or 80 today, that's a big difference, isn't it? But they had 500 and 600 years. And you can go back and read the genealogy in Genesis. Some of these individuals had years to let their light shine. Some that God was working with. But how long is eternity? God gives us just a few years to learn how to walk in His way of life. Are we willing to become lights? Are we willing to eliminate all of the darkness? Goes back to the sermonette that we heard earlier. What is our attitude as we approach this kind of a subject, this kind of a topic? How do we think? You know, I told you I'd help you maybe try to understand how long eternity is. I heard a sermon several years ago when I was out in California. Of course, maybe you have to be there to really understand the analogy I'm going to give you. But this particular minister, I was quite young, by the way, this particular minister in his sermon touched on eternity. And as I told you before, that's a concept that's hard for any of us to really get our brains around. But he gave an analogy as a part of his sermon. I've always remembered it because it struck me as being mind-boggling. But in the analogy that he used in his sermon, he used El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Do all of you know what El Capitan is? It's an enormous granite rock that sits on the west of Yosemite Rock in Central California. The face of it from the ground, from the valley floor to the top is a little over 3,000 feet. And it's a huge granite rock. I don't know how wide it is, but it's enormous. I've driven along the bottom of that and looked up at it. It's actually a favorite place of a lot of rock climbing enthusiasts. They're there pretty much year round, climbing the peaks or climbing the face or the various faces of that mountain. And there is a way that when you leave Yosemite and as you're driving out, I forget exactly, it's been years since I was there, but there's a way that you can drive out and get up high enough to where you're up a little bit higher than the peak of El Capitan, and you can see out over the mountain and the surrounding mountains and the valley of Yosemite. But this thing is enormous. It's an enormous gray granite rock. So he said in his message, he said, picture El Capitan. Now this is his way to explain how long eternity is. But he said, picture El Capitan, huge granite rock. And he said, imagine that every morning a sparrow lands on the top of the mountain, and for a few seconds he polishes his beak, rubs his beak on the rock, and he flies off. He does this, or a sparrow does this day after day after day. And he said that when El Capitan no longer exists, that's the end of eternity. When is that? It's never. It's never. And that example has always stuck with me. Always stuck with me. But we start in John chapter 21 because this is where all of us want to be. This is what we have our hearts and our minds set upon, is being a part of that family. When the Father in Christ dwells with all of their family, as shown through the example in John chapter 21 through the city of New Jerusalem. Now let's go back to the beginning of the story. Let's go back to John chapter 1. John 1, and beginning in verse 1. John 1, beginning in verse 1. It says, in the beginning, I think some of you may have thought I was going to turn to Genesis, but this is really the beginning of the beginning. But in John 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. And again, already we can't really relate to this, can we? If we just stop here and just think about what Christ is telling us, You know, it's beyond what our mind can comprehend. Two beings, no beginning, no end, always in existence. How? I don't know. God one day is going to give us the ability to understand that. Going on in verse 3, it says, all things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. So here we see that everything physical was made by the Word, who became Jesus Christ. All things, and through him all things created. Now, let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. And let's begin in verse 1. In Genesis 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, that's what John told us when we read that in John 1, verse 1. But here we see in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so this statement agrees with John. Stands on its own. It's a statement of fact. We just read that. In Job, we're told that when this occurred, that the angels shouted for joy when the heavens and the earth were created. The Bible tells us that God is the creator. We just read that in John chapter 1. The Bible also tells us that God is not the author or the creator of confusion. So what happens between Genesis 1, verse 1, and Genesis 1, verse 2? How many years are between those two statements? Verse 2, Genesis chapter 1. The earth was, or it should be translated, became. The earth became without form and void. Tohu and bohu. Waste, empty, desolate, confusion. That's what those Hebrew words mean. And it goes on to say, and darkness was on the face of the deep. You know, something happened between Genesis 1, verse 1, and Genesis 1, verse 2. And I'm not going to take the time this afternoon to go into the detail, but I'll refer all of us back to Isaiah chapter 14 and Ezekiel chapter 28. And we have the detail, the account of the rebellion of Lucifer. And we know what Lucifer did. We know how he was described. Lucifer was described when he was the covering cherub. He was described as brightness. That's what his name means, brightness or light bearer. He's also referred to sometimes as the morning sun. This was a being, this was an entity that covered the throne of God that was bright. He exhibited brightness. The Bible doesn't tell us how powerful he was, but he was a cherub. But it says he was created perfect and that he brought light or he brought brightness. And then later on in the account, in the gospel accounts, Jesus told his disciples that he was there when he saw, in this case now, Satan fall like lightning to the earth. He was there. This was before man was ever created. So sometime between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, there was a rebellion in heaven. Lucifer sinned. He lost his preeminence that he had, that he was created for, and he was banished to the earth. He and along with a third of the angels that he convinced to follow him. And he became the enemy of God. And I would speculate that when he rebelled, he lost that brightness. He lost that ability to be a light bearer, although we're told later on by Paul that he can transform himself and his demons as ministers of light. But in terms of the brightness that he was created with, he no doubt lost that. So when Satan was banished to the earth, Christ said he saw him fall like lightning, destruction and darkness occurred. The Bible doesn't tell us what all took place, but there is certainly physical evidence that we can see or that the heavens can show that something happened that probably God did not intend or certainly was not part of his original creation. So now we go back to Genesis chapter 1, the rest of verse 2, because it says the earth became filled with darkness. And then the rest of verse 2 says, the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Verse 3, and then God said, let there be light. And there was light. Those are the first words recorded of what God spoke. Let there be light. Verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. You know, yes, light is good, isn't it? Light is very good. Darkness is not good. Again, I'm speaking metaphorically, and in some ways, literally as well. Most of us would not do very well if we were stuck in darkness all the time, would we? And maybe not do as well if we were stuck in light all the time either. You know, a number of years ago, I was on a business trip, and in the back of the seat in front of me was one of the in-flight magazines. I don't even remember what airline I was traveling at the time. But in it, I came across an article about a fishing guide and a charter that was up in Alaska and read this account of how fishing was in Alaska and these huge king salmon that they were catching. And I thought to myself, you know, I need to go to Alaska. It would be so much fun to go there and go fishing. This was back in the mid-1980s when I came across this. So I took the magazine, stuck it in my briefcase, didn't think much about it until a few weeks later, and I came across it again. And I thought, well, I'm going to call this guy. This was a fellow that was mentioned in the magazine article. I'm going to see if it's possible to book him for a fishing trip. Called him up, answered the phone, talked to him for a while, made an arrangement to come up. So myself and three other fellows at work, we all decided we were going to take a summer trip to Alaska and go fishing. This would have been late, I think it was in late May, maybe early part of June. Made all the arrangements, headed out to Alaska to go fishing. I'd never been that far north before. And so when we got there, the fishing was great. The weather was a little cool. But one of the first things that we noticed that when we got there, that at 12 o'clock at night, it was still light outside. There was plenty of light. I think the sun actually dipped below the horizon sometime around 1 o'clock in the morning, because from about 11:30 to 12, you had this period of twilight. And it was light enough you could see to drive. And we were walking through this little city that we were in. And going to bed at night, because we had to be on the water at 6 o'clock in the morning, we went to bed at night when it was light outside. And we woke up in the morning when it was light outside. So during that particular part of the year, I think Alaska must get about 20 or 21 hours of light. Now, not all that sun, but the biggest part of that sun. What do you think happens on the backside of that when it's wintertime in Alaska? What happens to the 20 hours of light that you enjoy in June? Well, the 20 hours of light end up becoming mostly dark or dark twilight. I think the sun shines maybe 3 hours or so. You actually see the sun very, very low on the horizon. And so we learned very quickly that in summertime, going to Alaska is great. Now, I've never been in the middle of winter, so I don't know what that's like. But the next year, we had such a great time. The next year, I called a guy up, same guide, went back fishing. 2 years go by. Call the guy up to go back fishing. We loved it so much, we want to do this all the time, right? Call the number. He answered it. Told him I want to come up in June, take advantage of the king salmon that are running. And he said, well, I'm no longer in Alaska. I said, where are you? He goes, I'm in Florida. He sold his charter business in Alaska, and he moved to Florida. So we chatted for a little while, and he finally, you know, he gave me a number of reasons why that didn't work out for him. But, you know, one of the reasons that he came up with, one of the reasons he told me, he said, I just couldn't handle the winters. The darkness and the cold in the winter became so much on my psyche that I just had to get away. He said, I couldn't deal with it. And I remember it was because of the fishing in Alaska that I subscribed to Alaska Magazine. And I've been a subscriber probably for 20 years, that magazine. And every so often they'll have a story or a feature about some person or some family that deals with winter in Alaska. And the last one I read was about a lady. She was not in a large town, certainly was not in the city. And it dealt with how she, what all she went through to deal with the darkness of Alaska. And in her article, or in this article, there were 3 weeks that she didn't even step outside her home. And for 3 weeks, the only light she had was either a kerosene lamp or a candle. And so she wrote, or she was describing to the author of the feature, the writer of the feature article, what she did. And she went through to say that she had to do this and do that just to keep her mind engaged. Light's good. Darkness is not good, is it? Darkness affects us in a very big way. You know, we live in a world that is constantly influenced by Satan. Satan is the enemy of God. And it's out of this world that you and I are being called. You know, we read back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, that Satan changed. And the world became different, the physical world became different. But he was also banished to the earth. And so his way of life has been here since man was created. Let's go back to John chapter 1. I should have told you to keep your place there. But over in John chapter 1, we'll continue this really opening part of John's gospel, because he details the beginning of the Godhead. We read through verse 3. Let's pick it up in verse 4. John 1, beginning in verse 4. It says, "In him," referring to Jesus Christ, "was life. And the life was the light of men." Verse 5, "And the light shines in the darkness." And then John adds this statement, that the darkness did not comprehend it. The darkness did not comprehend it. So we read in Genesis 1 that God separated the light from the darkness. And in chapter 1 here of John, verse 5, John is using light and darkness again as a metaphor to show that only God can reveal truth to those whose minds are open to it. Only God can reveal his truth. The Greek word that's translated comprehend in verse 5 is the word katalambano, katalambano. It means to lay hold of so as to possess as one's own. Or it can mean to apprehend, or to seize upon, or it can mean to take possession of. So John here, the very first part of his gospel, explains that the light shines in the darkness, but those who are not called cannot take hold of the truth. They cannot understand. They cannot process it. They cannot live by it. Now, God's message, God's gospel, it's veiled to those who are not called, those who don't have their minds open. They can't understand it. Can't even embrace it. Don't like it. And of course, that's reinforced by Satan and Satan's thoughts. But unless God opens a person's mind, there's no desire to embrace his truth. There's no desire to even have a deep understanding of the things of God. And until that occurs, that individual or those individuals are ruled by darkness. And again, metaphorically speaking, spiritually darkness. Or spiritual darkness. Paul goes on and tells us, let's turn there, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul tells us that the God of this world, we know is Satan, has blinded mankind. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, let's begin here in verse 3. 2 Corinthians 4, beginning in verse 3. It says, "But even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing. whose minds the god of this age has blinded. Again, that's the reference to the one who became Satan. Originally was Lucifer. Lest, notice what Paul says here, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine on them. And so until our minds are open, until God works with us on an individual basis, calls us, our minds are closed. Our minds are veiled in the darkness that's controlled by Satan. Verse 6, for it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness. And again, we read that literally, but it's also very much true in a figurative statement as well. That God commanded light to shine out of darkness. And we'll go on in verse 6, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So Paul clearly tells us that until we are called, until our minds are open, that the truth of God is veiled. Those individuals are directed, led by the darkness. They walk in darkness. But Paul said that you and I, you read it earlier, that we are sons of light, those that God is working with. We're sons of light. And that we are to be lights to the world. We're to be lights to those around us. And so as we think about the upcoming Holy Day season, how bright is our light? How bright is our light? How far does our light shine? When we're around people, whether it's family members who have not been called, maybe it's our neighbor, maybe it's individuals that we work with. Do they see us as examples of the lights of God? Or do they not see a difference? Do we shine as sons of light? Again, these are all questions that we should each ask ourselves. Hopefully we all are shining. But maybe there's areas that need to be put more into focus. That there's areas that maybe we're not shining as brightly as we can or should. And I think that's part of the examination process that we'll go through as we approach the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. But Christ told his disciples, and that includes you and me, that they were to be lights around those who they were with. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. We're all familiar with this particular comment that Christ makes. But beginning in verse 14 of Matthew chapter 5, he says that you, that's referring to his disciples, which includes you and me, says you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And then he says in verse 16, he says, so let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. You know, that's our mission. That's one of the things that we as the called out ones, the sons of God, the sons of light, we're to be a witness of God's way of life. And that witness is to glorify our Heavenly Father. And that glory may not truly be manifested until individuals that we've come in contact one day have their minds opened and have their hearts opened to God's truth. That may be when the real and true total fulfillment of the glorifying takes place, as they'll remember their experience around you or around me. But Christ says that lights are to be seen, not hidden. And when we look at this from a spiritual perspective, we live in a very dark world, and you and I should be a light in that dark world. None of us need to go through an exercise of rehearsing all the headlines of what's taking place. We're all aware about what's going on in the world around us. Certainly all aware of what's taking place in our own country. It's sad to see some of the things take place that are taking place. As a youngster growing up, I never ever imagined that we would get to the point where we're at. And maybe we aren't anywhere near the end. I don't know. The end being in terms of just the amount of lawlessness and corruption that takes place. But this past week, I did come across, well, I think most of us probably saw the headline, but this past week, Robert Kraft was arrested for soliciting sex at a massage parlor in Florida. Do all of you know who Robert Kraft is? Nobody knows who Robert Kraft is. Oh, okay, there we go. He is the owner of the New England Patriots football team. And the reason I'm bringing this up is not to castigate him, but to use him as an example that points to a problem that I was not aware that is as large or as significant as it is. When I read the article about what took place, not that they gave any graphic details, they didn't, but one of the sidebar comments of the article they read said that they hoped that an individual such as Robert Kraft's stature would shine a light, use that word, would shine a light on the problem that the world has right now. And that problem is that the amount of human sex trafficking in the world, this blew my mind. I don't know if it will yours or not. And this is adults and children. But the amount of human sex trafficking in the world is a business that generates over $100 billion a year. Had no clue that that took place. And this is just those who are forced into that. Doesn't include those who volunteer to be in that line of work or line of practice. So as more of this information comes out, as more of our society degenerates, lawlessness, you know, corruption, evilness, violence, it's going to increase. And as it does, God's people, you and me, we're going to stand out more and more if our light is shining, aren't we? We're going to be very different. We should be very different. We should look differently. When I say look, not in our physical appearance, but in our actions, how we conduct ourselves, our language. You know, I think there's coming a time when God is going to allow, in some way, some fashion, all of us to give an answer. Some of us may have already done that. Some of us may have already witnessed in ways that maybe we don't know or understand. But I think there's a time coming when this will be even more of an occurrence, when we have to give an answer for what we believe and for what we stand for. And it won't be just my church teaches this. It'll be I believe this because that's what the Bible tells me. Let's go back and look at the account of the Apostle Paul giving an account before King Agrippa. Let's go back to Acts chapter 26. This is actually part of a very long dialogue in the Bible. It begins in Acts chapter 22. But Paul has been accused of sedition and has been arrested. He's been put before the king at Jerusalem, going first to Festus, and then Festus sends him to King Agrippa. And so Paul has to give an answer because the Jews have accused him of plotting against the local government, against Rome. And he has to give an answer to the king, and so Paul begins to describe the process of his conversion. That's the part of the story we're going to pick up on. And it begins in verse 13 of Acts chapter 26. And so Paul is recounting to King Agrippa what he went through. He says, "At midday, O king, along the road, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining around me and those who journeyed with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew language, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?' Or 'Why are you persecuting me?' It is hard for you to kick against the goads." Verse 15. "So I said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But arise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose.'" So God is revealing himself in this way to Paul. What was the purpose? Continuing in verse 16. "To make you a minister and a witness." A minister and a witness, both of the things which you have seen and of the things which I will yet reveal to you. Most of us probably have not been a witness as defined by giving testimony in a court of law. I have. It's not that fun. Has anybody ever had to give a witness regarding a traffic accident, for example? Have you ever been involved in or seen something you had to stop and give an account, right? So we can give witness by what we say, but more importantly, the witness that we will give is what we do with our actions, what our motivations are, how we conduct ourselves. You know, there used to be statistics from the church going back years and years ago that, and I doubt this has actually changed, that most new individuals who come into contact with God's church came because of either a family member, a relative, or a coworker. In other words, they were around one of God's called out ones, one of the sons of light. And they were motivated to pursue that or ask questions. But here we see that Paul is relating his conversion experience to the king. And it goes on, verse 17, he says, "I will deliver you from the Jewish people as well as from the Gentiles." And again, this is Christ talking to him, "to whom I will now send you," verse 18, "to open their eyes in order to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God," or to the power of God, "that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who are sanctified by faith in me." Paul was a witness. You are a witness. I am a witness. Not all of us will be ministers of Jesus Christ, but all of us are witnesses. Not by what we say, but how we live our life. And does our life reflect the brightness of God's glory, the brightness of God's truth, or the brightness of God's way of life? Again, these are things that I hope we'll ask ourselves as we think about the upcoming Holy Day season. Paul further addresses the concept of being a light. Let's go over to Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1 and beginning here in verse 12. It says, "Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light." Again, here's another title for you and me. Saints in the light. That's how God looks at us. Verse 13, "He has delivered us from the power of darkness and he has conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love." In other words, he's transferred us from the bounds or the bonds of darkness. He's taken us away from that, and he's caused us, or causing us, I should say, to be moved into the kingdom of his Son. And we already read that Christ is light. completely devoid of darkness. And then he goes on in verse 14, he says, in whom, referring to Jesus Christ, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sin. So going through conversion, we're overcoming darkness. We're overcoming the spiritual darkness that the whole world is under. Christ lives in us. Christ resides in us. And through that process, he is transferring, as Paul just told us, transferring us from darkness to light. And it's a process that we'll go through for as long as we are alive in this form or in this body. We're going to be learning and developing how to be better lights of Jesus Christ. Paul told us in Philippians 2, verse 5, I won't turn there, that let this mind, the mind of Jesus Christ, be in us as part of that translation or transformation, I should say. Ephesians chapter 5. Again, a section of scripture that we know well. And I'm not going to go through all of the scriptures covering this particular subject, but just a couple here, beginning in verse 8 of Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5, verse 8. He says, Paul writes here, he says, for you were once darkness. You were once darkness. Didn't say walking in darkness, but he says, you were darkness. In other words, that was at one time our nature, the nature of darkness. He says, but now you are light in the Lord. And then Paul gives this direction or directive, walk as children of light. And then parenthetically, he says in verse 9, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all. It's goodness, it's righteousness, and it's truth. And then as children who are to walk in light, he goes on to say in verse 10 that we are to find out what is acceptable to the Lord. That's a part of the examination process that we are going through all of the days of our life. What is acceptable to the Lord? You know, there was a time in our history, for those of you who've been in the church for a number of years, where those who were in charge wanted to find out what was acceptable to the world around them. Remember those years back in the 1990s? They wanted to know what would make them acceptable in the eyes of mainstream Christianity. Remember those days? Were they looking, were they determining what was acceptable to God? No, their reasoning was, what would be acceptable in your eyes so that we would not be looked upon as being, quote, different? I remember those discussions. I knew individuals who got caught up into that. And so where did this line of reasoning take them? Where did the feelings of wanting to be accepted by mainstream Christianity, where did it lead them? Eventually, to do what? Eventually compromise God's law, compromise the Word of God. And so instead of being sons of light, for some, they quickly turned from being sons of light back into the darkness that they were called out of. Again, I'm not here to judge or condemn. That's up for Jesus Christ to determine. It's up for him to correct, and he'll rectify that at his time or whenever that time occurs that he deems to be the appropriate time. But looking back on it, what fruit did it produce? I mean, it scattered people left and right, didn't it? There's only a small percentage of people who used to attend in God's church that are still attending anywhere today. In fact, the fruit of that reasoning, what would make us acceptable to those around us, for the most part, it led to people just casting off religion altogether. Didn't even bother to stay with anything that deals with religion. And so over time, not everybody, but over time, many just simply returned to the practices of the darkness of the world that they were called out of originally. But Paul goes on in verse 11, again referring to being called out of darkness, being changed from darkness into sons of light. He says in verse 11, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. And so I hope that's what is on your mind. I hope that's what's on my mind. If there's areas in our lives where there are unfruitful works, where there are dark spots, that we will in fact expose them and we will repent of them and we'll ask God to shine His light or help us to shine His light on those areas so that we change. Light covers darkness. Darkness is the absence of light. And so does our life and actions shine brightly in this dark world? Do those around us see our light? You know, when I was young and starting out in life, the world was much different than it is today. It was still dark by God's standards, but it was nowhere near what we see today. You know, I just wrote down a couple of points here that things have changed dramatically just in my few years of existence. But as I think back when I was a youngster, maybe a young adult, early 20s, you know, it never occurred to me that marriage could be defined in several different ways. Never even crossed my mind. Never occurred to me that gender was a choice or a change that we could make at any time. I mean, that seemed pretty straightforward at that time. You're either male or female. Nothing in between or nothing outside of that. And it never occurred to me that as a child or youngster growing up, that a child that survives an abortion attempt, that's actually born alive, is now able to be killed because the mother doesn't want it. Never occurred to me that would happen. But these are just small examples of what's taking place. Like I said, I think all of us are familiar with what's going on in the world around us, and I don't want to dwell on all the negativity. We see that all the time. Unless you don't read, watch TV, or communicate in any other way. You know, there are probably times that I wish on one of my properties up in Ashe County, I could just go sit, turn off everything, sun shining, warm, birds chirping, grass is green, ants crawling on the ground. Just kind of stay right there. Be really simple, wouldn't it? But that's not what God has called us to do. We just read that God has called us to be witnesses, to witness His way of life in a world that's dead and dying. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 6. I got to start wrapping this up quickly. Genesis chapter 6. I'll try to do this quickly. Genesis 6, beginning in verse 5. It says, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You know, his mind was totally filled with evil and confusion. Verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. You know, God has emotions. You and I have emotions. And God was grieved. It made him sad. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air, for I am sorry that I've made them. In verse 8, he says, but Noah found grace in the eyes of God. I wonder how Noah felt. You ever wondered how it was for Noah to be the only light in a world that was completely dark? Again, metaphorically I'm speaking, spiritually looking at it. He was the only light. Peter tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Do you think Noah had it easy? I doubt it. You know, there's not detail that's given to us. If it was important, God would have recorded it. But you know, he and his wife and his three sons and their wives were the only ones spared. Only ones that were protected in a world that God was going to destroy because it had become corrupt and violent beyond understanding. In fact, the violence and the corruption was so bad that God had to destroy man and start over through Noah just to preserve humanity and to preserve his plan. It was so bad. He had to destroy all of mankind except those eight that he saved. And so when we read this account, do you think that God hates evil and violence? He obviously does, doesn't he? And I'll ask us one more question. Do you think it could ever get this bad again? To where God felt he had to destroy mankind? Well, turn over to Matthew chapter 24. In Matthew chapter 24, verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. You know, that's both in terms of the corruption and the violence, as well as the attitude that, hey, everything is just normal. You remember other passages in that chapter talk about them giving and taking in marriage. Life was going on as though it were normal. They were wretched, didn't even know it. So as we begin to approach the end of this age, is it going to be easy to be a light? Is it going to be easy? I don't think it was easy for Noah. You know, there's a verse in Genesis chapter 6 that talks about God not striving with man, but for 120 years. Now, you can read that in a couple of different ways. Was that how long he gave man to repent? Or was that an indication that man would have his life cut short? No more living till you were 500 or 600 or 700 years old. Only live to be 100, 120. Whatever the time period it was, it's non-salvational. Whatever the time period was, it wasn't easy for Noah. So let's wrap this up for this afternoon. Let's begin to wind down. You know, God doesn't promise that our life is going to be easy either. But Christ did tell us that his yoke was easy and that his burden would be light. And God tells us that only through his way of life is real happiness and contentment ever achieved. So the world's tough, it's dark, it's a nasty place, but God does expect you and me to shine our light. Let's read a couple of verses in John as we conclude here this afternoon. I won't make a lot of comments on them, but let's go to John chapter 3. John chapter 3. And we'll conclude quickly here. John chapter 3, beginning in verse 18. He says, he who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation, verse 19, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light. Men love darkness rather than light. These are Christ's own words, because their deeds were evil. And he goes on to say that for everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light unless his deeds should be exposed. You know, this ties back to Matthew chapter 24. And he goes on in verse 21, he concludes this thought. He says, but he who does the truth, he who obeys, he who follows in my way, it said, he is the one that comes to the light, and that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God. John chapter 8, verse 12. John 8, verse 12. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world, and he who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but he will have the light of life. He will have the light of life. John 15, verse 19. John 15, verse 19. We often read this, or we do read this sometimes at the Passover service. If you were of the world would love its own. Again, he tells his disciples, he's telling you and me the same. Yet because you're not of the world, I chose you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. And then he says, remember the word that I said to you, that a servant's not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. You know, it's going to be a tough part of life when that occurs. I don't think any of us feel today that we're being persecuted. Some in the past were, some of the early New Testament Christians. But there is coming a time when this will be on the scene again, that God's people will be persecuted. Why was he persecuted? Why did the Jews hate him? Because he was a light to their evilness. He was a light to their way of thinking. And he was a life that they refused to embrace. And so they hated him for it. They wanted to destroy him. In Matthew chapter 24, we know that's the Olivet prophecy. I just want to look at just a couple of verses here as we conclude. But in Matthew chapter 24, let's begin with verse 8, referring to Matthew chapter 4. He says, all of these are the beginning of sorrows. Now he's referring to things in the verses above that really have been happening down through the centuries, but they will increase in intensity as we get closer to the end of man's age. But he says, referring to those things mentioned before, he says, these are just the beginning of sorrows. And this Greek word here that's translated sorrow means the earliest birth pangs. The earliest birth pangs, or the earliest pain felt. I've never had a baby, but those of you who have given birth, you can probably relate to the early pains of childbirth. And that's how Christ referred to the things that were mentioned in verses before verse 8. But then he goes on in verse 9, as the intensity goes up in the world around us, he says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and they will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations or peoples for my name's sake. Why? Well, they hated Jesus Christ. Why? He was a light that they rejected. You and I, if we fulfill God's purpose, are going to be lights that shine brighter and brighter as the world grows darker and darker. And so there is coming a time when we're going to stand out even more than we've ever stood out before. You know, light and darkness do not coexist. Darkness is the absence of light, and light covers up all darkness. And so a time is coming, and I believe it's going to come, when lawlessness that Jesus Christ describes in verse 12 really takes hold of our nation and the world around us. The time is going to come when every man is going to give an answer, give an account of the light that shines from us. So as we approach the upcoming Holy Day season, you and I should be giving God thanks every day that He's called us into truth and into His light. And so as we think about the upcoming Passover, the fact that Christ was willing to put His life down, was willing to die, have His blood shed for our benefit, we should appreciate and give God thanks that through that process we have our penalty for eternal death paid. We have an opportunity to have our lives changed because Christ said that He would live in us. If we ask, He will live in us. So as we go through the upcoming weeks, let's make sure that as we think about our lives and as we look at our spiritual condition, as we consider where we're at spiritually, as we examine things that are taking place in our life, as we look at the deeper parts of our thoughts, reflect on our actions, reflect on our attitudes. Let's ask ourselves, are there areas of darkness in my life? And as we go through this process, and as we ask God for His help, let's make sure that we expose those areas of darkness, and that every aspect of our life, action, attitude, word, reflects the light of Jesus Christ. You and I are sons of light.